Hello. My name is John, and I am a grateful member of Al-Anon. I have to set my little clock up here. One of the things that I've learned is that if I don't make it into recovery in 15 minutes, I probably won't. Thank you very much for inviting me. I've only been down for the last night and today. I got lost in downtown San Jose and had a wonderful time riding around and seeing all the lovely houses and going up and down the one-way streets. It was really wonderful. I really enjoyed last evening, and I'm very grateful that you invited me to come. And I always have to start with a little prayer to my higher power that I say today what I need to hear. Because if I say what I think you need to hear, or if I try to entertain you, I'm in my disease. And I hope today I will stay out of that and talk mostly about recovery. I was born into an alcoholic family. My mother was the first alcoholic of my life. But the alcoholism extends far beyond that. In my father's family, his older brother was an alcoholic. And my father grew up, in a very real sense, taking care of him from probably high school on. And in my mother's family, of the five women in that family, three married alcoholics and three became alcoholics. So clearly, there was a family disease. I have four older sisters, and there was another member of the family named Elizabeth, who was the family maid. Elizabeth was a source of unconditional love. I was the youngest, and when I was about three, Elizabeth left. She moved out of state for 2 years, and then she came back. During the time period when she was gone, I was home alone with my mother and my youngest sister, and in that time period, my mother sexually and physically abused me. I was between the ages of 3 and 5. I say this up front because it was one of the primary shaping forces in my life, and because it is not often you hear men speak of physical sexual abuse. But it is a symptom of the family disease of alcoholism. And it is also true that you do not often hear of women as perpetrators. The symptoms of this disease do not discriminate. Any and all of us are susceptible. Because of this abuse, I learned very quickly it was not safe to have real feelings. If I got angry at the abuse, I was beaten. I learned not to have anger. I learned not to have feelings. And then I learned how to have the feelings my mother wanted me to have. So I was well trained by the age of 5 to support my mother in her disease and to provide her with the emotional responses that she wanted when she needed them. And then I went to school and learned that I was smart and I could get lots of strokes by being smart and knowing and doing well. I also tried very, very hard not to ever go home. As a small kid, I would spend as much time away from the house as possible. I grew up in rural North Carolina and spent every summer working in the tobacco fields, and we were a middle-class family in a very poor area. We looked rich. We looked okay. As a matter of fact, we looked really good. And the inside of that house was a house of constant tension, hidden unhappiness. We sat at the dinner table every night as a family, and we talked, but nothing was ever really said. My father was affectionate with my sisters, but he was not affectionate with me. And I didn't understand that. I do remember him wrestling with me as a small boy, and at some point, wrestling became control, and it reached the point where he crossed a line of some sort where he was, simply would not allow me, the small little boy, to move. He was holding me to the point where I became hysterical. And at that point, he stopped touching me. And I know that it was his fear that caused that. I know that now. I didn't know it then. The reason he was affectionate with my sisters was because they demanded it. My mother told them, if you want affection from him, you have to demand it. Well, nobody gave me that message. And it's very, very interesting now that we're all adults and we talk. My youngest sister and I have clearly realized that we grew up in a different family from my three oldest sisters. There's a five-year difference between the twins, who are the younger of the older sisters, and my older youngest sister. And my mother's disease progressed significantly between that time frame. So while she actively worked to make sure that my oldest sisters had parties and activities available to them, by the time we were old enough for that, it had stopped. So we lived a really isolated life. By the time I was about 12, my three oldest sisters had graduated from high school. They were all valedictorians in our local high school, and they had to get tutors to pass basic classes in college. My parents figured out it's a pretty bad school, so my youngest sister and I were sent off to school, and that was a release, because here I was off in this totally different environment, Tennessee, and I excelled in school, and I was not at home. The first vacation, I guess it was Thanksgiving, I went home. I got back to my mother's house, and I literally walked around the house for 20 minutes before I could find a place where I felt... I was looking for a place where I felt comfortable enough to sit down. And finally, I simply sat down because I could not find a place that was comfortable. And I didn't know why. I didn't know why I felt that kind of anxiety in the home I grew up in. That summer, my youngest sister and I were at home, alone, and we realized how much my mother's drinking had increased. With all of her children gone, there were no restraints left. And she had hit the bottle really hard. She drank bourbon. She kept it in the pantry. And dinner would either be undercooked, overcooked, or burned, depending on how often she went into the pantry. One of the things that my mother did, and I guess what happens in a lot of alcoholic families, is the triangulation conversation where she would instruct me based on what was happening with that sister. And this, she's doing so and so and so and so, and you should never do that. And she did that a lot. And later, in talking with the other sisters, we realized she did it with all of us. And she held one up as the paragon to this one, and that was an unachievable goal, whereas to that one, it was this one who was the... And very confusing and pretty sick, pretty sick. But at age 13, I was home alone with her. I guess it was a Sunday, Saturday afternoon. And she had been drinking and was talking about one of my sisters. And I, you know, this sister was out teaching school. She had her own life. And I said that. I said, she's got her own life. She needs to live it the way she needs to live it. And my mother said, I live my life through my children. And it just sent chills up my back. And I said, you know, you can't live your life through me. I have to have my own life. And I can't live the life that you want me to live. I have to live what I need to live. And she got really angry. You can't do that. You can't shut me out of your life. You know, you have to live the life that I want you to live. You're going to be. And I walked out of the house. Now, all the time I had been growing up, whenever my father got angry, that's exactly what he did. He walked out of the house. And of course, he would leave five children with a drunk, but he left the house. I asked my aunt once about it, and she said, well, what did you expect him to do? Hit her? And that was what his choice was. He walked out, and I did it. I didn't walk far enough. My mother came out after me, screaming at me. And I said, what is it you want me to do? And she didn't really have an answer, so she went back in the house. And then I really did take a walk. But I did something at that moment which was very, very important for me in terms of survival. I separated from my mother. When I went to my first Al-Anon meeting, I heard a woman say, a non-Al-Anon approved, quotation, in the sense of, what she said was, if you can't detach with love, detach with an axe. And that's what I did at age 13. I separated myself from my mother. And I made a conscious decision that the only ally I had in that house was my father. And I began to build a relationship with him. And it took a while, but by the time I was 18, I had a really healthy, strong relationship with my father. And it was based on mutual respect. And I am profoundly grateful for that. He had his control issues, money, you know. He expected to be obeyed. What went on in that house was what he wanted to go on. And as long as you accepted that, you were fine. If you didn't accept it, then you had to have really good reasons. And I understood that. And while I lived at home, I lived according to his rules. And when I left home, I lived the way I wanted to live and let him know what I was doing. But my mother was profoundly jealous of my relationship with my father and would, in some subtle way, trigger anger between us whenever possible. I never really understood that until much later. One of my sisters pointed it out to me, saying, "No, you and Dad were having a fine conversation until Mother walked in the room, and then 3 minutes later you were yelling at each other." Oh, and then I started to watch it and realized that it was quite true, and it was her jealousy. I was supposed to take care of her. Went to college, majored in drama. Moved to Washington, D.C., where I was working in a small theater. And one of the heavy-duty parts of my life came out there, and that was that I could not simply participate. I had to turn my will and my life over to that activity. And I did. I was the publicity manager. I did props. I helped with the lighting. I was also performing and taking classes. That is an example of how my disease worked. While I was in D.C., it was raining. I was walking down the street and had my umbrella, which is a big rainbow umbrella, and saw this guy walking toward me, and he was kind of cute. And I went by, and I turned around and looked, and attractive from the behind, too. He turned around and looked, and then we walked on. About a week later, raining again, saw him again. He gave me his number. And that Friday, I, of course, went to one of the bars in D.C., but not really being a drinker, my method of going to the bars was like, go around 5:30 in the afternoon and then leave. So consequently, I didn't meet very many people, but he happened to be there. So we started to see each other, and within 2 weeks we had merged. I came from an alcoholic family and I didn't understand boundaries, and he came from an alcoholic family and he had no boundaries. And I didn't know it at the time, but he now defines himself as an alcoholic addict. Well, our diseases fit perfectly. I knew how to take care of people, especially someone who was a drinker, and he was what I wanted. He was a lot of fun. He knew how to party. He knew how to create a party. And there was something always happening around him. It probably took 6 months before I realized how heavily he was into speed. And I then later realized that he had been addicted to speed and the needle for 9 years before I met him. And then I said to him something that, for those of you who are AA alcoholic addicts, should, if you ever hear this from someone, run. I said, well, why don't you try and use the drugs less and depend on me more? That wasn't going to work, but we didn't know that at the time. He actually did try to cut back, and since he was living in his hometown and knew everybody and everybody knew him, he was finding it very, very difficult. So he decided that we needed to move. And I didn't like cold weather, and he didn't like hot weather, so we moved to San Francisco, where it's never really hot and never really cold. And we had been there about, well, just before we moved, my father had been diagnosed with cancer, and that was a really difficult time. I wanted to be present for his process, and I couldn't. And I couldn't be present for his process because my mother demanded that I be present for her. And it made it profoundly difficult. And that is my primary regret around his death, was not that there was anything unresolved between the two of us, but that I really could not be present for him because my mother could not allow it. I had to be her support. But when we moved to San Francisco, he died shortly after we had moved. I came home for his death and then came back to San Francisco. And my partner had found a drug dealer who delivered. We were living way out in the Richmond District, and because he selected where we lived because he didn't want to live in the Castro where he could easily have access to drugs, and then found a dealer who delivered. So we got rid of that dealer, and then he became a binger. So we would go months without him doing drugs or alcohol, and then a couple of weeks of binging, and then I would start acting out all of my father's behaviors, stopping the money, not paying bills, making sure that he couldn't afford to continue using drugs unless he went back to work. And since he had a difficult time working and while he was on drugs, you know, it was all the manipulation stuff that we do, thinking that it's going to make a difference. This pattern went on, and I realize now that it was a recreation of what my home family was. And it put me back in the place where I had been as a teenager. I was isolated, depressed, completely shut down, no friends, nothing but work, home, partner. And if you looked at me, you would think that's a really shy, introverted, depressed person. I'm not an introvert. Not by long means. But that's what I looked like. We met some friends, another gay couple, and got to know them. One of the members of that couple defined himself as an ACA. And I said, an ACA, what's that? And he said, an adult child of an alcoholic. And I said, so am I, so what? He gave me these books to read, and I couldn't read them. One of the ways I escaped in my home was by reading, you know, novels constantly. And I could concentrate and shut the entire world out and read for hours at a time. And I could not read these little thin books. So we went to St. Croix for 2 weeks and took the books with me. And we were there with that other couple, and my partner was wasted 8 out of 14 days. And I read the books. when we came back, I spoke to someone at work and I said, I need a counselor on alcoholism. And he recommended someone who lived in Oakland. And I said, that's on the other side of the bridge. I don't cross bridges. But I called the guy, and the guy recommended someone in the city. So I went to see her, and took her about 10, 15 minutes, and she opened me up to a well of rage. And I'm sitting there, and I'm going, what do I do with this? And she said, well, you're definitely an ACA, and you're in an alcoholic relationship, and I normally do groups, and I have a group starting in September. And I said, this is April. And she said, well, you can pay me $70 an hour, or you can go to Al-Anon and get it free. And so I said, okay, I'll go to Al-Anon, and I'll take your group in September. That was April 15 years ago. And I went to my first meeting. It was the beginner's meeting at the Belcher Street. And there were six people there. And I felt really uncomfortable. And then the main meeting started after the beginner's meeting. And about 150 people walked into that kindergarten. And I was initially terrified. And then the meeting started, and I felt like I had come home. Everyone in that room, while the details and circumstances may have been different, had the same experience I had. They had all been damaged by the family disease of alcoholism. And they were talking about it, and they were telling the secrets, and they were being honest. I think it was the first time in my life I had ever experienced that. And they said, you should go to six meetings a week. And I did. The first week I went to six meetings. And I went to six meetings a week for the next 2 years. Because that's how crazy I was. And I needed that. And one of the things that I did early was volunteer to do coffee in one of the meetings. Someone said, you know, you should do service. Well, being someone who likes to overcommit themselves to whatever it is I'm doing, since I was already doing six meetings a week, I thought certainly I should do service. Well, I started to learn a very important lesson from Al-Anon in that moment. Al-Anon will not let you do everything. You can do one thing, but you can't do everything. So I did one thing in every meeting. And I became, that was the beginning of my service junkiehood, and it continues. And I find that doing service puts, my service work is where my growing edge is. That the service work that God gives me is where He makes me grow. I started as a literature person and coffee person because that's what I could do and what Al-Anon would let me do as a beginner. And I got to read the literature. And I had to be at the meeting. That's what was important for me. It gave me permission to be at the meeting. It allowed me to belong. And if my partner said, you have to go out again, it's like, well, I'm the literature person. I have to be there. I couldn't even think about the steps when I first came in, but I could do the slogans, and that's the word I couldn't remember earlier, slogan. I could do the slogans, and the first slogan that made sense to me was, there but for the grace of God go I. Because I could look at my family, and in my family, there were no alcoholics, but in my aunt's family, three of her four children were alcoholics. So it was obvious to me as a flip of the coin which side of this disease I got. And the other slogan that I took to heart was, mind your own business and know what your business is to mind. And that was a hard one for me. And the first thing that I was able to do was simply say, it is not my business to call in sick for my partner. It is not my business to, well, one weekend, he got really upset with me, but he was hungover and on the couch and looked at me and said, would you go get me some ice cream? And I looked at him and I said, no. The ice cream store was exactly half a block away. He could get off the couch and get it himself. I didn't have to do for him what he could do for himself. My partner got clean 3 months after I came to Al-Anon, and then 4 months, I guess in August, he got sober, and he started a program at 18th Street Services. He was going to meetings a lot, and he was almost fired from his job, but more importantly, he took a leave of absence to get sober from his job. And suddenly we were in a different world, because I was in recovery and trying to mind my own business, and now he was in recovery and trying to get clean and sober. The world changes when that happens in a relationship. And one day we were driving back, one evening, driving home. I'd been to my meeting, he'd gone to his meeting, and he was talking about how guilty he felt because he wasn't working. And I got this gut-level feeling and realized that I had to own up to my side of that street, which was that for 9 years during our relationship, whenever he didn't go to work, I made him feel guilty. He should have been at work. It didn't matter what drug he was doing, he should have gone to work. And here he was working a recovery program, but not working a job. And I had to admit that that is probably such an ingrained guilt mechanism for me that I was probably making him feel guilty. Wasn't intentional necessarily, but it's such a habit. And suddenly we realized that we had to look at our relationship in a new way. And we talked about it, which was in and of itself new, and we decided that we would let the relationship go. That is, we would not worry about the relationship. We would simply let it be, because we were both going through so many changes with our recovery that to worry about the relationship was just too much. That went on for 2 years, actually, and at the end of 2 years, we found out that we really liked each other and we really respected each other and we loved each other. That was a gift. It is not always the case, but for us, it was. It took me a year to get a sponsor. I don't recommend that. When I did, the first thing he said was start working the 11th step. And he explained how to meditate to me and told me I really needed to get a higher power. So I spent 3 to 4 months praying, meditating, also working the first 3 steps, but really working the 11th step. And I was really beginning to see changes in my life as I built that relationship, but it was not personal enough. I did not feel a real connection to the higher power. And one day I was beginning my meditation and I asked for an image. Give me an image that I can relate to. And I was given an image that I could relate to, which expanded to be a man, and then I was able to see his face and the eyes, and those eyes saw everything about me and through me and loved me anyway. And that was a profound gift. And I began to use that face, those eyes, in my meditation every day. And truly wonderful gifts started to happen. And then we went to the Serenity and Yosemite Conference. We got there Thursday night. Friday morning I got up and went and registered everyone. Came back. I wasn't feeling particularly well, so I went back to bed. I laid down. And then I woke up with the first of the incest memories. And I got my life blown apart. But for the first time, I understood why I always felt something was wrong with me. Why I thought something deep down was wrong. So it was a terrible gift. And I got really angry at my higher power. I worked so hard to build this relationship and had a wonderful sense of a higher power in my life. And then I was handed this bomb. But I was also given the strength and the tools to deal with the bomb. I was able to grow through it, to understand what it meant in my life, to understand why I lived in fear, to understand why I always felt something was wrong with me. And suddenly I was able to do a fourth step. And I realized that I had not actually done anything bad in my life. I was actually a good person. But I could never have believed that before the experience of the memories. I had another gift, and that was my service work. I had volunteered to be group representative of my Thursday night gay men's meeting in San Francisco. And I was the GR for that and going to the district meetings when I was given my memory. It's happening for you in that moment to the ether. And unless you specifically ask for it, you're not going to get feedback. But when you're in a business meeting where you're discussing issues associated with whatever business you're doing, whether it be a convention such as this or the district's budget or the intergroup's needs, you're dealing with people directly. You're actually creating relationships. You're reacting to other people's feelings. You're having your own feelings. Those were the things that never happened in my family. They never happened in relationship. And suddenly I had found a way to do that in Al-Anon, to practice the principles with other people in Al-Anon in a safe way. That was one of the most amazing gifts that service has given me. And it's why I keep participating in service. After my fifth and sixth steps, I was working 7 and 8 on defects, fear being one of them. And I had become district representative in San Francisco. And I got a call from the office worker who said, "We have to move. They sold the building. We have to move." And we're like, what do you mean? We can't just, move. But if they sold the building, they're going to have to give us some time. So he said the new owner had called and they were going to raise the rent. And I said, okay, what's his number? I picked up the phone, called the new owner. It turns out there was another space in the building for the same rate we were currently paying. It was just half the space. And it wasn't as nice a room, but we could afford it. We could stay. I did that without even thinking about it. And I went, wait a minute, what happened to the fear? Because before, any time I had ever tried to do anything, I was afraid. And I would go straight into paralysis. I had learned this method for dealing with it, which was, one, acknowledge you're afraid. Two, tell your higher power you're afraid. Three, call someone if you still can't do it. And then three, do it anyway. I had been doing that for several years, and suddenly that process had become automatic. The fear had been lifted, and that was another gift. I served as district rep, and as when you're a district rep, you serve on the Northern California Area Committee. And I was serving as executive committee chair during some very difficult times in the Northern California area. And those were painful lessons and major growth experiences. During that time period, my partner had gone to Southern California with his job and was commuting back and forth, and a long-term back problem had escalated to where he was in constant pain. They started putting him on pain pills, and then he had surgery. The surgery fixed one pain and created a completely different form of constant pain. And the surgeons gave him additional pain medication, and he told them he did not want to become addicted. And they assured him they would not addict him. And they did. Within 3 months, he was on morphine. And they would not listen to him. They did not believe that they were giving him drugs that were addictive to him. He had told them he was an alcoholic addict. Now, I went back into my disease. I became isolated. I let go of my service work. The only thing that I had left was my meetings. And I was crazy. I was living with an addict, and I was crazy. Finally, I told him, I said, I can't live like this. Something has to happen. And he said, well, they don't listen to me. And I said, do you want me to talk to them? And he thought about it, and he decided yes. And he took me to see his pain doctor. And the doctor said, well, we're not giving you enough medication to addict you. And I looked at her, and I said, have you ever watched anybody nod out in a plate of food? And she looked at me, she looked at him, and she said, what are you taking? She didn't know he had three different doctors prescribing. Well, his addict had taken over. He later defines that as a slip. But she heard him that time. With me sitting there, she heard him. So she turned all the medications over to his GP, so there was only one doctor prescribing, and he got it back under control. He was still on the medication because he needed the medication, but he was not abusing the medication. And I was still crazy. I was crazy. But I have friends in Al-Anon who know me and reached out and said, we need you. We have this service position. We need someone to do this. Will you please come? And I realized that that was my lifeline. So I stood for the position and became the alternate delegate in Northern California. And the alternate delegate for Northern California area really is the budget chairman. So we did the budget, and I worked in that position for a year, and I was once again in business meetings, face-to-face with people, and what happens at that level is you're doing service with people who have a whole lot more recovery than you do, and their defects are up in your face. And your defects are in their face. And you acknowledge it, and you honor it, and you know that you're all working a program. And it's a safe place, and you can succeed, or you can fail. And if you start to fail, they will reach out and help you, because they want you to succeed, just like you want them to succeed. It is a profound gift. Last September, I was elected chairperson for Northern California area. And the first 15 minutes after that, I was like terrified. And it is a gift. It is a gift of me being given the opportunity to lead Northern California through some major changes in terms of how the structure itself is organized. What we're really trying to do is give the job and responsibility of setting all of the priorities back to the groups. And that's very difficult because the groups don't necessarily want to do that. And we get to work with them to lead them to accepting what really is their responsibility in the first place. And that's just really exciting. And it is a profound gift of recovery for me to be part of that. And all of my procrastination and my fears and my not enoughness get up in my face, and I pick up the phone and I go, okay, we need to do this, help. And someone is there to help. And that's what it's really about for me, is practicing the principles and knowing that I can reach out to anyone in that group and I will be given the support that I need. And I know that I can go to my meeting And whenever I need support, encouragement, I can get it here in Al-Anon. It's always there. And I'm so grateful to my Wednesday Parnassus meeting, because during the time when my partner was re-addicted, they listened to me every week, bitching and moaning and whining and acknowledging that's what I was doing. I mean, I knew what I was doing, but I couldn't get out of it then. And they listened every week. And then when I started to come out of it, they listened to my process of how I came out as well. And it's really interesting to me to say this, but in 2 weeks, my partner and I will celebrate our 24th anniversary. It's not perfect. We got a lot of work to do. And we know how. This program has given us the toolbox, not only to work on ourselves, but to work on the relationship and our communication, and to make the relationship more honest and identify where the issues are. We've created some new unhealthy patterns, and we're recognizing them and starting to change them now. And that is a profound gift, because one, we can see what we're doing, and we can see where it's healthy and where it isn't. And we know how to reach into the toolbox, how to pull out whether it's a step, the literature, or certainly sponsorship, and use that tool to get more healthy, to change those old patterns. 15 years, I ought to be perfect by now. I'm not. Got a lot of work to still do. But I don't live in fear. I have joy in my life. Indeed, most of my life is joy. And I am profoundly grateful to this program and to all of you who have supported me in my growth and the changes that I've gone through. So thank you.